I wanted to locate texts on the possibility of prayer in the thought of Rav Shagar. How do we pray? With the acknowledgement that everything is relative and things are uncertain, and I don't have a set identity, and I can't understand God, and I have to work very hard to understand myself and accept myself. Where does prayer come in to all of this? So that's what's driving these sources. Again, with gratitude and thanks to Rabbi Levi Morrow for being generous with his research and translations and sources. Let's dive in. So we're going to look at source number one in pieces. Essentially, what we're going to talk about, and we've talked about this before, is the difference between ideology and faith in Rav Shagar. And Rav Shagar is going to talk about how ideology can become a form of idolatry, that if you're absolutely certain on your about your faith, it can verge on idolatry. If you're not open to the possibility of being wrong, then you're not open to the possibility of God either. This is in Shiurim on Likutei Moharan, on the teachings of Rabbi Nachman, and we're going to come back to Rav Shagar drawing on Rabbi Nachman's teachings further in the source sheet in the last essay that I brought. So the trap of ideological excess can lead to acting like an idolater, coding their opinions with words of faith. It's important to remember that an answer like perhaps is a real possibility in existence, which can be just as certain as certainty. Again, yes, Rabbeinu. If you're not open to the possibility of being wrong, then you can't accept the possibility of being right. If you're not open to the possibility that God doesn't exist, then you're not open to the possibility that God exists. The answer, so we're gonna zero in on this word perhaps as a real possibility of existence versus certainty. The very existence of a positive option itself changes the feeling of your life. For example, things in my life don't have to be good in a simplistic sense in order for me to have faith. It's enough that I have faith that things could be good, that the potential exists in order to experience the presence of God. Faith is not necessarily certainty, and therefore it's possible for a faithful answer to the question, is there a creator of the world, to be perhaps? From this perspective, the presence of faith in the world depends on people, on their readiness to accept the existence of God in the world, despite the lack of certainty. And it's specifically doubt that can lead to faith, because language forces us to define every phenomenon. And thus, instead of actually encountering the phenomenon, we suffice with defining it externally. Okay, so we put words onto things, and by doing so, we automatically limit it. We automatically make it less than it actually is. Once we translate it into the real world, it doesn't exist in the way that we mean to encounter it. Doubt opens up language anew in order to prevent rigidity and to enable us once again to come into contact with reality. If we say, yes, God definitely exists, this statement can lead us to block off the possibility of revelation. It is specifically the possibility to answer perhaps in regard to religious life that creates a space where the sudden possibility of revelation could take place. Essentially that you cannot be absolutely certain of your faith, because then it turns it into something that is rigid, that is stuck, that perhaps is stuck in an older version of yourself. So Rabbi Morrow brought this example. He said that he quotes an interview with Rav Shagar that he served on panels and would talk about when he was in conversation with other Rosh Yeshiva, of the idea of quoting someone else's idea of faith. Essentially, he gives the example of the idea of mitzvot, which we talked about as well, the idea of observing the commandments. And Rav Cook has this idea that observing the commandments is really a way of revealing what is deeply true to ourselves, right? So when we observe the commandments, we're really aligning with what we really are, our true identities, what we really want to do in life. And that's what mitzvot are. They're essentially allowing us to tap into our actual nature and identity. And for people who identify with that, says Rav Shagar, right? They're saying, if they're quoting Rav Cook and aspiring to that, they're being disingenuous at times, right? Because perhaps they held that belief at one point, but did they ever stop to consider whether or not that is true to their faith in this moment, to their experience in this moment? And holding on to that idea, if it was true at one point but isn't true in the present moment, would be worshiping idolatry or be worshiping a different version of yourself or a different version of God that you connected to in that previous version of yourself. And that would not be true faith. Faith is what your experience is in the present moment. And so Rav Shagar speaks out here against turning your ideology into idolatry, of introducing that doubt and introducing that word perhaps as allowing your faith to be live, to be in conversation with who you are in this present moment. And so in source number two, he also talks about the distinction between faith and ideology. It comes from a book called Briti Shalom, a book on Israeli politics and the state. And this piece is about, is from a discussion of the disengagement and the opposition to the disengagement. And there's some stark language here. Writes Rav Shagar in source number two, my impression of some of the people opposing the disengagement is that in contrast to their thoroughly ideological rabbis, they are driven by authentic faith. And this itself is what makes them so dangerous. What makes the religious terrorist dangerous is that he lacks a lack of faith. He lacks doubt. This lack is what enables him to murder. Right? Because if someone was really in touch with their faith, they would never come to murder. They would understand that it's absolutely opposed to the divine will. Paradoxically, lacking faith protects a person from transgression. Right? When you have doubt and you entertain this possibility of perhaps, that's what protects you from holding on to a belief so tightly that it becomes rigid and you come to something, chas v'shalom, something as grave as murder or other transgressions. Obviously murder is the one of the worst examples you could possibly bring. But if you believe that you're murdering in the name of God, right, that's not obviously not correct. And right, you need to revisit that. It's somewhere where your belief has become ideology, has become rigid and stuck. And you've lost touch with your living sense of faith. The faithless ideologue, in contrast, and faithless in a good way, is plagued by a hole that he attempts to overcome through ideology. Sorry, that you need faith, not ideology. Faithless is bad here. That's what he means. Doesn't mean with doubt. So let's say that again. The faithless ideologue is plagued by a hole that he attempts to overcome through ideology. And that's what makes him dangerous. In general, however, he will not go too far and will find formulations and justifications, even ideological ones, to prevent him from transgressing. So we must thus open up to the lack of faith, to the ability to cast doubt, to the ironic, distant gaze. Is such a gaze opposed to the fear of heaven? Not necessarily, right? So doubt and uncertainty is not the opposite of fearing God. And it seems all the more so, right? That it's necessary to keep in touch with your faith. In a certain situation, it itself is the fear of heaven, or at least it enables a powerful possibility for the fear of heaven. God is not a fact. He exists without existence. This is the secret of the Tzimtzum. Okay, and we touched on this in Rabbi Nachman, which is also the source of the lack of faith, as Rabbi Nachman teaches. Tzimtzum as in the explanation that God had to contract God's self in order to allow space for existence to be in the world. And so there is, as if to say, there are places in the world that are the halal hapanui, which we're going to talk about, an empty space, a void, of a place that we experience as void of God, as devoid of God, as if that were possible, right? In our experience, we experience it as devoid of God. And that's the Tzimtzum. So the Tzimtzum is God contracting God's self so that to allow us room for existing. This is the secret of the Tzimtzum, which is also the source of lack of faith, as Rabbi Nachman teaches, right? The internal logic is simple. God is not a fact. So how is it possible to believe in him? How can you believe in a not fact and not a fact? How? The answer is that you must conscript the lack of faith in service of the cause. Believe without belief, just as God exists without existence. Paradoxically, not believing in this sense can only function in tandem with believing, without which it would become simple negation, nothingness, simple absence, rather than absence that exists. This is the revelation of the Ein, the space of the God, of God being of the void with a capital V, nothingness. So not believing in this sense goes alongside believing. When we experience the void of God or the nothingness of God, it's that space, the possibility that God might not exist, or the uncertainty that allows us to also experience faith and certainty that God does exist, or belief that God does exist, not certainty. So, but being open to the possibility that God does not exist allows us to believe in a way that's more live, in a way that's more connected to our current experience, our lives, our living faith. Ideology, again, for Rav Shugar, is a way of formulating truths that made sense at one time, but if at a certain point you hold on to them without asking yourself if they still make sense, that becomes a certain form of idolatry. Being true to your inner self is not only holding on to what other people put forth as axioms of faith, right? You have to be in constant revelation of what is true for you at that moment in conversation with God. So faith, as opposed to ideology, is attentive to what's happening at this moment. Ideology may have made sense at one point, but is frozen in the past. Faith is live. To get to Daniel's comment, a quibble, but isn't he talking about the distinction between knowing where there is a certainty and a lack of doubt? A lack of doubt and faith where there is uncertainty overcome by our belief. Yeah, that's a good, I think that's a good way of putting it. And if I, Daniel, right, that there's a distinction between declaring that you know, which cannot be true, where there's certainty, as opposed to living with faith where your uncertainty is overcome by your belief at points. Yeah. Even within the concealment, certainly God is there. Absolutely. And we're going to come back to that teaching, right? Even in the places where we think God is not, that's where we find God, in the concealment. It's a good song too. It's a good teaching and it's a good song. So the question that this source addresses, how do we live with a narrative and then also live with a live sense of faith? And then we'll get to the meat of this class, which will be from Rav Shugar's essay called "Praying Without Hoping." So, in source number 3 on Tshuva and the disengagement, Rav Shugar writes, "We have to understand that in the postmodern world, we're incapable of bringing a winning proof in this argument. However, that does not mean that our claim has no merit. On the contrary, this is the test of faith." It does not draw its strength from the absolute truth, but from our choice and our loyalty to our narrative. The difference between us and the left is exactly the faith that this is our land, that our right to the land is ancient and immeasurably greater than that of the Arabs, and that we were exiled from our land because of our sins, but we never abandoned it. We never gave up on it. What Rav Shugar is that, what I want to take from this source is that he's asserting that there's no way to win an argument, whether this is talking about the disengagement, right? He's talking about the disengagement, but he's saying there's no way to win, but there doesn't mean that when you don't, that our claim does not have merit. Okay, interesting. So Valerie's weighing in and saying to know in the sense of Derrida is to know, recognizing that the tool of knowing is simultaneously exactly not what we are doing. We're unable to actually know. Right. So, but we don't give up on the claim. We still are allowing, I think, as Daniel is saying before, our faith to overcome our uncertainty. Oh, I don't know. I don't know how to how to formulate that word, Derrida. I'm assuming I'll cede to Valerie on this, on that point, Stacey. What I wanted to get to here in this piece, in the main piece of today's shiur, is Rav Shigar's essay called Praying Without Hoping. So there's an excerpt here, but then I brought the full essay translated by Levi Morrow and Alan Brill, and I think that's what we'll dedicate the rest of our time to. We're going to talk about the possibility of prayer. Okay, so if we're embracing this idea of perhaps, which he's going to draw on, he's going to draw on the teachings of Rabbi Nachman and Jacques Derrida to discuss how we can approach prayer, specifically through this idea of embracing the fact that we don't know for sure. We know without knowing. We know, as Valerie said, we know while embracing the fact that by doing so, we are not knowing. We cannot know. Both Rabbi Nachman of Breslov and Jacques Derrida taught that prayer as well as faith are only possible through absolute renunciation, praying without hope or future. Rabbi Nachman wrote, "This is when you pray without any intent for personal benefit, without thinking about yourself at all, as if you did not exist. Following the verse, it is for your sake that we are slain all day long." And in Derrida's version, prayer does not hope for anything, not even from the future. Okay, so our prayer without hope. Prayer without hope does not demand the typical religious self-sacrifice in which a person nullifies his self and his needs in favor of God. So it's not that I'm saying I want to do God's will. Rather, it embodies self-sacrifice in that purest prayer is located in the impossibility as total self-sacrifice, purposeless suicide. The purest prayer is located in the impossibility of prayer, and the impossibility of the very movement towards prayer. How do we approach the infinite? How do we speak to God from our limited existence? According to Derrida, prayer turns to the other without future hope, only towards the past. In return, it returns without a future. However, despite this, you pray. Is this possible? If this is so, we might ask, why indeed should you pray? Why should you pray if prayer means turning without hope? It seems to be the opposite of how we normally embrace prayer, right? Of turning to God with hope, with something in our heart that we want or need. So what does it mean to pray without future hope and we only turn towards the past? So Derrida answers, it's possible to pray without hope, not just without any request. Sorry, is it possible to pray without hope, not just without any request, but while renouncing all hope? If we agree that this prayer, pure prayer, cleansed of all hope, is possible, would that not mean that the prayer's essence is connected to this despair, to this lack of hope? Right, they kind of turn prayer on its head, the opposite of what we would assume prayer might be. I can imagine a response to this terrifying doubt. Even then, at the moment when I pray without hope, there is hope within the prayer. I hope minimally that someone takes part in my prayer, or that someone hears my prayer, or someone understands my hopelessness and despair. Thus, despite everything, there is still hope and future. But perhaps not, at least perhaps. This too, in regards to the terrifying nature of prayer. So prayer is terrifying. It sounds like prayer is terrifying in the sense that life might be terrifying in this perspective, that we face the world with uncertainty, renouncing hope, knowing that everything has this doubt cast upon it. But the redemptive piece here, right, is the moment that I'm able to embrace this and say, I'm not praying with the hope for anything because I can't. There is hope that someone is witnessing my prayer or my state of being, that someone can hear my hopelessness and despair, or if I want to translate it to less terrifying terms, someone can hear me in the way that I am now, right? Someone can hear what I'm saying, even if they're if the prayer is not hinged on hope for the future, it's that someone is with me here in the present. And so thus, that's what, there's still hope in future somehow, that there's still hope within the prayer. Okay, prayer is empty mechanical speech, but in some form or another, it cuts through what Rabbi Nachman calls the void, the halal hapanui, the empty space, and thereby overcomes the gap, even though it remains in the negative space of complete silence. It requires you to affirm two opposites, and here we're touching on the ayin that he brought up before. The ought, the yesh, and the not, the ayin. The empty space comes from contraction, from tzimtzum. As if God had removed God's self from that space, as if there was no divinity there, otherwise it would not be empty. Theology, right? We couldn't exist in the face of God, right? So God had to empty God's self of that space in order for us to exist. So we're confronting this contraction, this place of contraction of the ayin. But in absolute truth, there must be divinity there despite this. And therefore, it's impossible to understand the idea of the void until the future yet to come. So we're embracing at the same two things at the same time, and that's coming from this narrative of creation of the Tzimtzum. The Tzimtzum, the idea of Tzimtzum, of God contracting God's self, requires us to hold that God is both absent from the space that we're in, because otherwise we would have no room to exist within it, and to embrace the fact that late atar panui mine, there is no place that is actually void of God or devoid of God. So even in this space that God emptied God's self of, there must be divine presence. So we have to hold both of those things at once. In order to cross the void or transverse the void here, we do need, but we're embracing both at once, that God is there and God is not there. And it's impossible to understand it. I love how like the basic understanding of this is that you must just face this with not knowing, that, right? Hold all of these things at once, and it requires you to just to kind of, I think that's part of the nullification of self here, just to give into the fact that we can't understand everything, that it's impossible to understand because we're being asked to hold two complete opposites at once. And so Rav Shagar continues, even though both of them recognize the impossibility of prayer, Rabbi Nachman and Derrida do the opposite. They pray. Paraphrasing Maimonides' statement that God exists but is not in existence, Derrida and Rabbi Nachman ask if the not cannot also be ought, right? The yesh and the ayin, God's existing and not existing in the same place. Is it possible to pray without hoping? Is it possible to despair of hope and thereby... yeah, and thereby to receive it as a despairing hope, right? If the prerequisite to hoping is giving up on all hope, right? No, approaching God without a connection to hope, without an attachment to hope, and thereby to receive it, because there's that, it's replaced by that hope that we talked about of that there's someone listening and witnessing. Or a despairing hope that someone sees my despair in the darker terms here. Then there is a hope in a future and someone hears my voice. The connection to Maimonides is not incidental. Derrida saw the idea of negative attributes. Maimonides' negative theology is the basis for deconstruction and thus also for prayer. Similarly for Rabbi Nachman. This is prayer. And this quote from Rabbi Nachman's teaching. When we call to God with the attributes of flesh and blood, it's improper to describe and call to God with attributes and phrases and words and letters. Some found Derrida's statements about prayer incredibly shocking for the philosopher who for years was considered the standard bearer of anti-metaphysical radicalism, the guru of the believers in materialism lacking any beyond. Indeed, Derrida was forced to defend himself from criticism by thinkers, including thinkers that I don't have not yet studied. Jürgen Habermas, according to whom he was nothing less than a Jewish mystic. Okay, so here's the question. Is this claim not correct? Derrida's worldview is far from rationalist or anchored in philology. His deconstructive games sometimes seem not coincidentally like Kabbalistic Hasidic homilies. And he defended himself claiming that his project was a deconstruction of the values underlying mysticism. And in this, he was correct. So the question is, right, is this deconstruction not just mysticism? Have they just become mystics and Kabbalists? So let's go to the next paragraph. The difference between Derrida and the mystic is a matter of pathos. Someone once said that the mystic and the atheist say the same thing, nothing. I love this passage so much. They say the same thing. They say nothing. The difference is that the mystic says it with a capital N, with a feeling of tremendous freedom that breaks him loose from the constraints of reality. Meanwhile, the atheist says it as a depressing and terrifying possibility. Rabbi Nachman and Derrida perhaps expressed better than others did the gap, the difference between the word and what we expect to accomplish. The empty space, that halal hapanui, that is the source of the structural contradictions of reality itself, right? Because it's, again, devoid of God and yet must contain God. It allows us to exist, but how do we exist in the face of God? How do we relate to God from that space that is devoid of God? In Rabbi Nachman's language, the questions without answers. And yet they prayed. I love it, right? This is my bolding, my emphasis. This miracle happens in present tense, right? The miracle of prayer. This moment has no external justification, nor is it a result, rather an event. This is grace that is a possibility for prayer without promise. Prayer is when we call to God using flesh and blood qualities. He is then present for us in our calling to him. This is the grace of God. Without the grace of God, it would be improper to describe and call to God with attributes and phrases, words and letters. Right? It's impossible to talk to God in this way. It's impossible to reach God in our finite form. We don't know what we're doing. We don't know that it's possible. We try from our finite existence, and with God's grace, that's how we transverse the gap, how we reach God. And we need the grace of God to do this. And the question becomes one of grace. Paradoxically, this grace is dependent on the human renunciation of the will to ascend. Right? We have to understand as we're approaching God that we're not really able to do that. We can't transcend our finite being. We can't actually reach any mystical realm or go any higher. So we need that self-acceptance that we talked about. Self-acceptance, giving up on transcendence, is not true or false. It is word for word prayer. So we're coming back to this core of self-acceptance, of being very connected to who you are in this present moment. That, again, is what is an authentic, a sense of faith, is being attentive to what is in this present moment. And similarly, that's what's required for prayer. Now, it's interesting, right? So Stacy said, he's creating a circumstance in which we're surrounded by a deepened awareness of Hashem by making the negative space of unfaith somehow more faithful. Love it. Totally. I'm totally with that, right? That he's created the uncertainty, the lack of faith is what actually is the most faithful, because it opens us up to real faith. I imagine that's difficult for someone who is stuck in what he calls like an ideology, right? Someone who's like, no, I have faith. I make the declarations of faith. I recite the 13 principles of faith every single day. And this is what I understand them to be. And I don't change them. I don't challenge them. So I imagine that this type of theology is a direct challenge to that kind of faith. Valerie said, I've never been comfortable hoping to through prayer. To look at the selfness of the other and the everythingness and the nothingness, the oneness of the infinitely many. Making requests. through prayer has been difficult for you. Interesting. Yeah, the nullification of self is what you've, very interesting. So Valerie identifies with this. But Stacy says, my prayer only feels valid when I'm doing, when all I'm doing is saying thank you over and over. Asking for anything feels wrong. Wow. That's so interesting. It feels amazing when you can sense that you can't break away from God. Wow. Beautiful. I love that you're connecting to it. Okay. So, and I also love this idea of grace, right? Because it does, right? Even speaking to God just feels impossible. And many, many thinkers have said the same. I'm not the first to put it in those simple terms, right? But, and that's the question of, and so God's grace is what allows us to approach, but also its dependence, as Rav Shagar, on the human renunciation of the will to transcend, right? You're just being in front of God, self-accepting, giving up on transcendent, and that allows you to have prayer. Self-sacrifice, suicide. I don't think he literally means suicide. He means self-sacrifice, nullification, I don't know, is a condition for prayer because it liberates a person not just from the language, but from its logic as well. Prayer is therefore divine grace because it is impossible and yet it occurs, or at least perhaps occurs. See, and it's still in this sense of perhaps, right? I'm doing all of this effort and I'm still embracing the perhaps. This perhaps is important because the perhaps elevates it to the realm of worldly possibilities. It therefore exists if only as a possibility. Again, if I don't hold the possibility, if I don't hold the perhaps, then if I'm not open to God not existing, if I'm not open to this not working, then I'm not open to the possibility of it working. I have to be open to the perhaps in order to open that realm of possibilities. And it therefore exists if only as a possibility. Perhaps someone hears and takes part with me in the prayer. Is this enough to create hope? I pray, but am I certain that I will be answered? No. So there is that element of asking still, right? I'm being answered by something, maybe, at least answered by the knowledge that I'm, right? If only to be answered by the knowledge that I'm being heard, right? But I don't even know that I'll get that answer, or I know that I won't get that answer. That someone hears, who is this someone? We say God, but this word lacks any independent meaning. It's enough for me that I hear, but who is the I that hears? I believe in the deep I, an I with a transcendental horizon. This is what the Hasidim called the root of the soul. Where there is an I like this, there is God. A deep I with a transcendental horizon. And it's very, again, I think there's a tying of the self to God, right? When you know self, you know God. It's a very deep teaching. And it's not in the way that we talked about before, or it's in contrast to the model where it's saying discovering the self means really aligning with the will of God that's external to you. That's not right. We said, no, it's about being in touch with self. Yeah. Okay. Interesting, Jack, right? That's an interesting question, right? It means discovering the self and through that it's connecting to God. And Jack asked, how can self-nullification coincide with this deep I? I think the nullification itself is what he's calling the transcendental horizon. I can't articulate it fully. And if others have thoughts on it, I think Jack's question is strong, right? What does it mean to connect to an I, but also be nullified, right? Nullifying the self as a prerequisite. I think that's the key, is the transcendental part, right? Of saying, I don't believe that I'm able to transcend. I connect to whatever is here. That is the I that is here and the root of my soul, right? He is pointing at something larger than me as an individual. Self-nullification is the material I. Interesting. I don't know how else to articulate it. Anastasia, I like that. You know, what does it mean to nullify the self and then find an I there? He's definitely talking about something broader. Then again, me as an individual, in my limited sense, my finite sense, the root of the soul, we can come back if we can chew on it. I'm holding your question. The problem of attributes that Rabbi Nachman pointed to is the impossibility of language actually doing what it claims to do, actually making contact with the real. If I understand God as something that exists outside of me, I've strayed from the real, right? So I guess being in touch with the I is also being in touch with this infinitude, right? It's not the finite I, it's the transcendental I. And if you guys can add more, you know, illuminate that more, happy to hear more. So if I understand that as right, so I've strayed from the real, yet in truth, psychological reduction of faith is possible when raised to the Lacanian real. Reaching the real requires the human renunciation of the will to transcend itself. Only after this, it is correct to say that someone is the I. Reaching the real requires human renunciation of the will to transcend itself. And only after this, it's correct to say that someone is the I. That's, I think, the most clear formulations that we will get in that last paragraph. We have to renounce the possibility of transcendence, be in touch with our I, but not and nullify, but yet nullify the self. What does it mean to be an I with the transcendental horizon? It feels mystical in a sense. It's evading like actual articulation. And then the strongest formulation we had is like, you know, what's the difference between this and a mystic? It's the not with a capital N or not with a lowercase N, like ascribing a transcendental quality to the nothingness that we're experiencing, or you know, a divine quality to it, as opposed to a nihilistic framework. All right, so Betsy wrote, I've heard this described during prayer as floating in God when removes the barriers to contact one's inner reality or point, which is connected to God. The transcendence happens in experiencing that, of removing the barriers to your inner quality that is divine, right? That might be what he's talking about, of like touching the, right, the transcendental aspect of the I. And yet he's saying embrace our inability to transcend, but there is some, right, they're saying like there's like a point of God within all of us. Maybe, is that what you mean, Betsy?
Yeah, and you lose yourself in it. It doesn't lose itself in you. So that's a nullification. You lose yourself in it, and you can get to that state in a prayer experience through the words, but the words aren't the end goal, and the words are not the point.
Right. The words are just the springboard. Absolutely. Right. And we talked about the self as an ongoing revelation of God, or like our experience of reality is ongoing revelation of God. So that would seem to coincide. All triteness aside, can't we find an I in our silence? Well, I don't think that's trite. I think there's that's there too. That's there too. I think the embracing, you know, encountering God in silence and not knowing is also part of this. Absolutely. I don't know if that, right, as Betsy said, like the words are kind of a vehicle to this. They're not the point. When the you becomes you, Stacy says, the present. Yeah, beautiful. Valerie says, if in the Hasidic sense, we are centered on a literal part of the same God that is everywhere, obscured or otherwise, the transcendental I is simply God. I think that's where I'm finding difficulty in embracing this, of saying like, I think he really means that our experience of reality is under unfolding revelation of God. And like, what is that? It's hard to embrace. I don't know. It's hard for me. It's hard for me personally to embrace necessarily, because I'm like, who am I? What does that mean? But I do like the limitations we saw, at least, of saying like, of course, this doesn't mean doing your, you know, acting on every whim and pretending that that's God. There are some things that are certainly not God's will, and we know that would be acting against God's will. Derrida thought he wasn't a mystic, but yes, I mean, I think Rav Shugar is a mystic. I think that's okay to say. I think, and Stacy said, right, his book is called Faith Shattered and Restored for a Reason. Being able to be an atheist and then come back is a profound statement of the power of faith. Beautiful. Right, faith shattered and restored. And it's almost as if, right, it's the shattering of that faith is the prerequisite to the restoration of the faith, of actually having a full faith, of being in, it's part of process. It's shatter faith and find another pane of faith glass. I love that. It's beautiful, right? But it's also a prerequisite of saying we're going to break down the ideologies. We're going to break down what things that we might have been holding on to from the past that so that they don't become idolatry, so that we're in touch with our understanding, you know, our existence as we are now, with our faith in this present moment. Shattered is also a reference to the prime, to the myth of the shattering of the vessels. But that's also the shattering of the vessels is a myth that accompanies our existence, right? Of saying that the divine presence can't be contained within the physical, finite limitations of this world. And I think that's also it's reflecting what he's talking about, right? Of saying we can't actually confine God or relate to God from our finite existence. And this is what, right. So the vessels are continuously being shattered. It's different than the actual myth, right, of the story of the shattering of the vessels, but I think it's an iteration of it as we experience the world, the vessels and the deconstruction. Yes, the deconstruction as well.